In this part of Focus 580, we will be looking back to charges of professional misconduct that were made against a number of American historians. And all of these cases came to light and, in fact, became something of national news in the year 2002. Two of the people who were involved were quite well known, and two a bit less so. And each case is a little bit different. But our guest this morning in this hour of the show, Peter Charles Hoffer, takes them as an opportunity to think about what historians do and about how the discipline has changed over time. He's authored a book on this subject, which is entitled Past Imperfect, the subtitle Facts, Fictions, Fraud, American History from Bancroft and Parkman to Ambrose, Belisarius, Ellis, and Goodwin. The book is published by Public Affairs and came out, actually, I believe, last year. So the book certainly should be available in library or the bookstore if you'd like to look at it. Our guest, Peter Charles Hoffer, is professor of history at the University of Georgia. He's also a member of the American Historical Association's Professional Division, which audits the standards of academic historians' work. He is the author of many books of academic history. He was also invited to advise the American Historical Association on the issue of plagiarism. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions and comments, of course, are welcome from people who are listening. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people are brief in their comments, as brief as they can be, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along and get as many different people in as possible. But, of course, people who are listening are welcome to join the conversation, and we always appreciate that, and callers add a great deal to the show. So the number, if you want to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Whichever those numbers works for you, you can use it and be a part of the conversation. Professor Hoffer, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
It
seems a little bit striking to me that not only did we have these four cases that got so much attention, but they all happened in the same year. Did that lead historians to think that something serious was going on in their field, or was this just something of a fluke?
Well, of course, it's something of a fluke, but the cases had been going on for years and years and years before that. For example, Ambrose, Stephen Ambrose, who is probably the most notable case of serial plagiarism in American historical writing, was plagiarizing materials from the 1960s. So it had gone on and on and on and on. Mm. In fact, it was the outing of Ambrose that led to a series of accusations made publicly, first by online newspapers and bloggers. And then, of course, they sort of came together, reinforcing one another. But, you know, in the past year, we've had a series of accusations of plagiarism of leading law professors, of a dean, and a very, very important historian. So you could take just about any year and find significant cases. Mm-hmm. 2002 was important, but not unique.
What I'd like to do is have you talk a little bit about each of these cases, and this is in the book. You look at basic issues in history first and then look at the cases second, and if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to do it in the other way around to refresh people's memories and then give us something to talk about. You look at the cases of Michael Belisarius, Stephen Ambrose, Doris Kearns Goodwin, and Joseph Ellis. And in, as I said, each of these is a little bit different, although in the case of Ambrose and Goodwin, we're talking about plagiarism, essentially the same thing. Taking them in the order that you do in the book, first with Belisarius, this was a man who got a lot of attention for his research on gun ownership in early America. In fact, wrote a book titled Arming America that was published in 2000 that made this basic argument. He makes a basic argument in the book that contrary to what we might have been led to believe, that gun ownership in early America was rare and that guns didn't really become widespread until they became a mass-produced product. And it was very controversial. A lot of people committed to the idea of gun ownership objected. And as it turned out, maybe they had good reason to object.
First, let me a tiny correction.
Yes.
His last name is Belisle.
Oh, pardon me.
It is French. And with our common Middle West traditions, I don't know if you are from the Middle West originally, we tend to... We have trouble with foreign sounding names.
Yes,
we come from all over the world.
Yes,
but it is Belisle.
Very well. I appreciate the correction.
He published an article that won all sorts of prizes in 1996, in which he made basically the same argument that you've outlined very succinctly and I think correctly. That article drew fire, if you'll forgive the metaphor, from the IRA and from NRA and from everyone who loved gun ownership. And it seemed to us, those of us who were his friends, and I counted myself certainly a friend, that he was under attack for political reasons. As it turned out, in the book that was published in 2000 by Knopf, which won one of the coveted Bancroft prizes and was reviewed on the first page of the New York Times book review, all of that very, very favorable, that there were problems in his research. In particular, early in the book, he made the argument that looking at probate records, something that he did, he claimed, very systematically, going to the archives, going to the legal records themselves, he claimed that he found very few guns in those probate records. It was an astounding result because other people who'd looked at the probate records had found slightly over half of them had guns in them. He found 14% of them, which meant, along with his anecdotal evidence, that there were very few guns around. What there were in armories. They were taken out by the militia. They paraded around with them, shot them off, got drunk afterwards, and went home. When he was accused of research misconduct, he fell back in a series of strategic retreats, including arguments that his research materials were destroyed in a flood in his office, that his website where he'd put up the real evidence had been hacked by someone. A whole series of increasingly absurd responses to the criticism. Finally, Emory had enough. They asked the American Historical Association's a professional division to which I belonged from 2002 to 2004. It's only a three-year elected term. I'm no longer on it. He asked them, Emory asked if we would look at the case. We said, you have to make a complaint. They weren't willing to do so. We demurred. They then went to a blue ribbon panel. The three historians on that panel looked at the evidence. They talked to Belial extensively. They even hired a researcher to go back and follow his tracks, that is to say, the places where he said he went. And they concluded that there were serious problems. In fact, as I say in the book, that he had fabricated much of that evidence.
Mm-hmm.
He resigned under fire. Again, forgive the pun, no pun intended. And he's more or less out of the profession, but he's still writing. He's still doing research. He's still working on a major project. But he's not employed, as far as I know, by any college or university.
Yeah.
It's a very sad case because he's a good guy. What happened was he was out to prove a point. And, you know, historians, they source mine. They look for friends in the past. He was looking for evidence. He may have found in some places fewer guns than people had said. And then the allure of the ideology itself, the ability to say to the National Rifle Association or to opponents of gun control, listen, you're wrong. Plus the fact that he was winning all sorts of prizes for his work led him to go farther and farther and farther along the trail of falsifying what he had found.
I suppose, though, you have to ask yourself the question about him and perhaps others who might have acted similarly. Did he never think that he would be found out, and did he ever worry that, in fact, if he was found out, that it would destroy his career?
Well, it's true of all four of the people that I look at in detail. All four of them knew what they were doing was not right. They knew, however, that it had brought rewards. It had enabled them to publish faster. It enabled them to become more prominent. It had enabled them, perhaps in their own minds, to win prizes. And you sort of develop these rationalizations in your own mind. Well, it's okay. Or I've gotten away with it. Or no one will find out. You sort of wall off like an abscess. You wall off the misconduct from your own thinking. Did he know that he hadn't gone to these courthouses? Did he know that he hadn't gone through all of those records? Sure. He had to, unless you're assuming that he was in a fugue state for 4 years where he wasn't sure where he was going. He knew. I ran into him. I didn't put this in the book, but I ran into him at a conference, and I said, "What's going on?" This was in Boston. We just talked for 2 minutes, and he said, "They're out to get me." And I said, "Well, you know, keep your powder dry." Because you know, they were out to get him. What I didn't know is that he had put himself in a position of peril where they would get him. So, yes, they know.
Yeah. Let me introduce again very quickly our guest for this hour, Peter Charles Hoffer. He's professor of history at University of Georgia and is author of the book Past Imperfect, and looks at how it is we do history, how that has changed over time, and as I mentioned, also looks at these four cases of professional misconduct by historians that all came to light in the year 2002. The book is published by Public Affairs, and if you're interested, you can seek it out. Questions are also welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. In the next section, you deal with charges of plagiarism against two writers, Stephen Ambrose and Doris Kearns Goodwin. And these are two people who were very well known, were people who were best-selling authors, people who were frequently interviewed on television, and were charged with plagiarism. The allegation against Mr. Ambrose was that he had done it a lot over many years. In the case of Doris Kearns Goodwin, the cases were smaller. There were fewer. But the basic charge is the same. And I guess when I think of plagiarism, maybe because I'm here on a college campus, I think of when someone buys a term paper and puts their own name on it and hands it in, or copies something directly out of an encyclopedia or a source book. Is it indeed clear that that's what these two did?
Well, plagiarism actually has a much broader definition than that. That's what you've described, certainly is plagiarism. Mm. But for example, let's say I read a book that you wrote and I really liked it, and I decided to paraphrase a couple of pages from you, but not to summarize them, not to put them in my own words. What I did was I changed a few of your words and then made believe that they were mine, the rest of them, put them in, and then perhaps I put a citation at the end to a block of pages where it looks like I have read your book and am summarizing, but in fact what I'm doing with a few changes, I'm copying. That's plagiarism. Hmm. What if I like the sources, the primary sources, the documents, the original evidence that you went and found? So I go to your book and I take out those quotations. I take out the stuff that you found, and then I put it in my book, and my footnotes go to the originals, not to you. That's plagiarism. And that's what Ambrose did, both of those things.
Hmm. In the case of Ambrose and also of Doris Kearns Goodwin, I guess one of the questions I find asking myself is, these people, it seemed that they were talented historians, good writers, smart people, that they didn't really need to do this. Why did they do it?
Well, both of them, when they were confronted with evidence of this, explained their methods. Ambrose said what he did was he would cover a large desk with all sorts of materials and go back and forth among them as he wrote. And what happened was as he did that, he wasn't as precise and as careful. And he said, next time, I'll make sure that if it's a quotation, I put it in quotation marks. I don't leave them out, that if I go to a source, I'll say as quoted in. He said, next time I'll do that, because remember, he was a professor for many, many, many years. I mean, he was accused of plagiarism after he had retired from the University of New Orleans. But before that, he had been a professor for many, many years. And then, sadly, before he could do that, his last book was a memoir, which he didn't have to put quotations in because he was talking about his own life. And you can't plagiarize yourself. And then he died. He passed away at the end of 2002. So he never got the chance, really, to show that he could do it the right way. Doris Kearns Goodwin, her two big books, both had problems of this sort, not as consistently, but problems that she attributed to a sloppy research assistants who would take down things but not put the quotation marks in, or would paraphrase but not indicate exactly where they had taken it from. And the result was that she put her name on pieces of work that could be accused in parts of plagiarism. And she said, it's my fault because I should have gone over it. I had the final responsibility. That raises a somewhat different problem. Ambrose used his family as research assistants, his children. Doris Kearns Goodwin hired research assistants. In some of the more recent cases, there are law professors who have third-year law students, very bright, very able people, as research assistants. And in almost all of these cases, there was evidence that the research assistants had made the mistakes. But that raises the larger question of, if your research is being done by research assistants, and they're writing it up, and then you're incorporating it into your work with your name on it, with a thank you to the research assistant somewhere in the book, are you the author? And if you're not the author, then they are. And if they are and you're using their words, then aren't you a plagiarist? And that is an issue, the issue of authorship. That is the much larger looming issue, because all over the place, in government, in the law schools, in museums, you have people who are writing things and not getting credit for them.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? Someone who was listening this morning in Indiana on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. This is sort of a general question. Perhaps you've run across it. Unfortunately, I don't remember some of the mathematicians' names, but a number of months ago I was reading a history of mathematics, and I just was astounded at the number of mathematicians who have tried to, you know, basically steal each other's work. Even from the, you know, the physical sense of, you know, going in and trying to get the paperwork, and also, I guess, the more technical aspect of reading the papers before they were actually published, and then just lifting out sections of it to add to their own work without any kind of footnoting. I know a lot of this was done, you know, particularly in the 17th century, but I presume it's been going on for some time. And these are not just regular mathematics; these are the big boys. And I was wondering, there seems to be a, I don't know, I was thinking about my days of plagiarism. I remember, I think I was in the sixth grade, and there were a number of us who went to the library. I think there must have been 10 or 15 of us. All we did was copy out the Encyclopedia Americana, turned it in, and then we all received a lecture from the teacher about, is this really your work, etc. And we were just following the footsteps of, you know, people we knew before. And in a sense, it finally came to me, you know, what plagiarism really was, and then became really uptight about footnote and everything, and that's just about as crazy also. But I wonder if you could say anything about the mathematicians, if you know anything about that period. Thanks a lot.
Well, you raise a whole raft of wonderful questions. The first is there a difference between plagiarism in a work that you hold out as your own, as original, and simply copying in a book that you say, listen, this is just the reporting of information that you wanted. So, for example, if a student remembers and then copies verbatim from a textbook on an exam, is that an F for plagiarism, or is that an A for a very good answer? So originalism, you know, the fact that you're holding it out as an original work. So yes, it's plagiarism if it's in a paper that you've turned in, like your sixth grade paper. But it may not be plagiarism if you're simply answering a question on an exam. Now, your mathematicians, Mathematicians are, of course, infamous for this kind of thing. If you remember the Tom Lehrer song, the Lobachevsky song, Lobachevsky was a Russian mathematician who was widely reputed to be a plagiarist. And the tagline of that song, only, you know, please be sure to call it research, still has bite. But mathematicians are not the only ones who run into these kinds of problems of originality, because we all depend upon other people's work. You know, mathematical proof submitted as an original, a prize winner, if someone figures out, you know, for math's last theorem or whatever it is, that will make your entire career forever and ever and ever. So the temptation to look over someone's shoulder is there. On the history side of things, I've seen cases of people who go and they sit at a conference and they hear a paper given, and lo and behold, that paper appears in their work before the graduate student can publish it as his or her own. So, as I say, there's a series of wonderful questions.
Well, this gives an opportunity to raise one of the issues that you deal with in the book, and that is if you look at what has been over time accepted practice within the field of history, I think, and you tell me if I'm reading this wrong, there would have been a time when what Ambrose and Doris Kearns Goodwin had done would at least have been common practice and perhaps would not have been considered to be problematic.
Absolutely. And in the book, I offer some examples of how honored, esteemed, great 19th century historians like George Bancroft and Francis Parkman played fast and loose with the rules that we now enforce with respect to plagiarism. In the 19th century, it was still a crime, but it was a crime that no one prosecuted. It has become much more serious, and I think will continue to be more serious. And I think the reason is that so much text now is electronically scannable, so that, for example, journal articles are now online with JSTOR and Muse Project and various other places, so that if I found a particular phrase in a student paper that was given to me that sounded familiar, I could take that phrase, go on and look at my electronic journals at the University of Georgia on Galileo, and I could find if that came from somewhere and wasn't quoted or cited properly. So the more things are electronic, the more text is electronic, the easier it is to find where text has been borrowed or purloined and not properly attributed.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to one of the fourth case that we didn't talk about, and that was the case of Joseph Ellis, who was also a well-known historian, at least within the field of history. Was well known for writing early American history. He won a Pulitzer Prize. He won a National Book Award. He was also one of these people that was widely interviewed. On this very program some years ago, we talked to him about his book that he wrote about Thomas Jefferson.
Uh-huh. Did he tell you about his Vietnam War service?
No, he didn't. That did not come up. It was sometime later that, of course, we all read about the fact that here now, it wasn't people were raising questions about his academic work. They were raising questions about his apparently colorfully embroidered personal history.
Yes.
Where among other things, he told people that he had been a combat veteran in Vietnam, and it turns out that was not true. Why in this? This is something sort of different. I mean, as I say, the issue is not the man's academic work. The issue is what it is that he said about himself.
Well, I think, and I said in the book, that reinventing a more heroic Joe Ellis probably helped him write his wonderful books. I think he's a terrific author. In fact, I think all four of them write great stuff. I think it helped him to re-enter a world that's very hard sometimes for us to go back to the late 18th century, where honor meant so much, where you sort of hid your private self behind a public mask. I think it helped him do that. And, you know, I can tell you this, I guess, because after all, it's already happened and it's true. There was some objection from his side of the street about whether that story should appear in Past Imperfect. And the question that was raised was this professional misconduct or simply a personal delict? And if he had simply made these statements to interviewers, which he did, in fact, before American Sphinx, before the Jefferson book, he was interviewed by the Boston Globe, and he told them about his military service, about how he had been in the 101st, and how he had been a combat veteran, and so on. If that had been all of it, I personally would have said, gee, I guess life up there in South Hadley or wherever Mount Holyoke is not that exciting. But he also told it to his students. He told it to his students at Mount Holyoke. He told it to his students at Amherst because they have a consortium there where you teach around. And it was a very effective teaching device because he was talking about literature in the Vietnam War era, and here he was a guy who had seen it all. And we're not supposed to do that with our classes. I mean, all sorts of things you can do, but you're not supposed to invent yourself in front of them, and you're not supposed to manipulate them that way. There's a lot of stuff going on now in state legislatures about student bills of rights because of what a former academic named David Horowitz has been arguing, very well funded, that students are being manipulated by liberal professors to their detriment. You get a case like this, and it just goes, it steps beyond the line of what a professor can do as good pedagogy, as legitimate pedagogy, to stimulate students, to inspire students, to make students think critically, which is, after all, our real job in the humanities. Not imparting information so much, it's getting the students to be able to think, to evaluate critically. And he challenged all that, which made it a professional question.
Michael Belial lost his job, was disgraced. Joseph Ellis was embarrassed, had to publicly apologize, stepped down from teaching for a while, but went back to teaching. And in fact, not very long ago, we talked about a recent book that he'd written, a book on George Washington, of all things. I cannot tell a lie, George Washington. And it seems that Joseph Ellis has been somewhat rehabilitated. Doris Kearns Goodwin, I think her career was not overall damaged. Stephen Ambrose really died with this cloud over him that he never did have the chance to respond to. If you ask the question, looking at the price that these individuals paid for what they did, was it appropriate, do you think, particularly for those people who managed to come through it, sustained some damage to their reputation, some embarrassment, but still have careers?
Well, if Doris Kearns Goodwin was teaching at a university, there would have been a more serious punishment than simply canceling some lecture dates. If Stephen Ambrose was still in harness and not retired, I think there would have been some very serious questions about him remaining in his teaching position. I mean, after all, we tell students, don't plagiarize. If you plagiarize, you're going to get an F or something more serious, and then you have a professor who does it. So had he been still at a university, I think there would have been a more serious penalty. Joseph Ellis, I'm not sure whether he got back his prestigious chair. I know that he had to sit down for a year. But he carries this with him forever. I mean, the Washington book, His Excellency, is a fine, fine book. But when people called me and they asked me, the first thing they asked me was, is it all okay? So you know, the punishment is still there. The punishment for professional misconduct in the end is professional shame. And I think they've all had full helping of it.
Well, we're a little bit past the midpoint of our conversation. We have two callers who we'll get right to, and I also would like to introduce again our guest, Peter Charles Hoffer. He's professor of history at the University of Georgia, has served on the American Historical Association's professional division. That's responsible for auditing the standards of academic historians' work. He himself is the author of many books of academic history. And if you're interested in reading about this subject, you can look for his book, Past Imperfect, and it is published by Basic Books. We have a couple of callers here ready to go. First in line is someone calling from Danville, line four. Hello.
Good morning. When you gave examples of plagiarism earlier in the show, are there additional ones? Or I'm interested in whether using the same title as another author would constitute plagiarism.
I'm sorry, I missed the word. Using the same what?
The same title for your book?
Oh, no. You can't copyright a title. And Past Imperfect, Mark Carnes has a book entitled Past Imperfect, which is about movie history.
There are three other
books called Past Imperfect. I like the title, and so do we all.
Well, it's certainly relevant, to the topic, but I didn't know whether one could use the same title.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, thank you.
All right, I'll go on here to line number one. This is a caller in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
It's just one brief remark here. It seems as if they're really two different levels of meaning to the word plagiarism. The word, I notice sometimes you talk about this as being a crime. Well, the legal definition of plagiarism is not the same as a historian's definition of the word plagiarism. I mean, if you in order to be brought a suit against you in court, you have to have so many words that are exactly the same. If you just steal a person's ideas, that's not plagiarism in the legal sense of the word. And in fact, even if you use the exact words in certain circumstances, you would never win a case. Like if you were describing the assassination of Lincoln and you said, Booth took two steps back and then he moved to the right, and so on, and that was the exact words that some previous historian had used, no, you couldn't win case in a federal court with that. So, because they would just regard that as a minimal importance. So,
the
legal definition of plagiarism is not the same as what historians.
Yeah, plagiarism isn't. Let me put it this way: there is no legal delict, there is no tort, there is no civil action for plagiarism. Plagiarism is not a legal category. What you're talking about is copyright infringement. And what you're saying, absolutely correctly, is that there is a there are certain kinds of legal exceptions to strict rules of copyright, a certain amount that you can reprint without getting permission and or paying for the reuse of someone else's words. And yes, there is a legal action for copyright infringement, and you can use a certain number of lines freely for educational purposes or whatever, except, of course, if you quote one line of music. ASCAP will sue you instantly. But there is a fair use exception. You're absolutely right. What's more, the other point you're making, that if you're looking at the same primary source as someone else, describing some historical event, not only is that primary source probably out of copyright, so you don't have any copyright infringement problems, but also you don't have to cite, in my opinion, you don't have to cite to the place where you first saw it, the secondary source where you first saw it. If you go back to the original, reread the original, and then use it, even if you use the same exact words. So those are all kinds of exceptions. But again, plagiarism is not a crime in the legal sense. It is, however, in its Latin origins, the crime of kidnapping. So
right. But what I wonder is that an historian would regard, let's say somebody uses these earlier descriptions of the assassination of Lincoln, and it's pretty much exactly worded the way it was by some writer back in 1870. Does an historian then, if you have a passage that's maybe 30 or 40 words exactly alike, would an historian consider that plagiarism? Or
did you put it in quotation marks? Oh, not you, but I mean,
did the
author put it in quotation marks?
You don't. It's description, and you use that description. And pretty much the same words, maybe changing a word here and there. Would an historian regard that as plagiarism?
If you have used fragments of it and embedded those in your paragraph, or you have taken it pretty much as it was, we tell our graduate students, put it in quotation marks. Even if you don't have footnotes or endnotes or notes, even if you just have a bibliographical essay, you want to avoid even the danger of someone accusing you of plagiarism and then having to defend yourself. If you take something from somewhere, use the original, put it in quotation marks. That's what the quotation marks are for. That's why they were invented. That's why they're there. So you can show that this is someone else's that you are borrowing, that you are using. It's okay to use it.
Yeah.
But use the quotation marks.
Yeah, right. But now let's say it was mostly paraphrased, but maybe one or two sentences were exactly alike.
Put the one or two sentences in quotation marks.
A historian would be a pedant if they put a footnote for every single thing. You know, John Wilkes Booth stepped backward. You know, then.
No, you don't have to do it. First of all, most of us use block citations anyhow. So you get one little number at the end of the paragraph, and then at the end of the bottom of the page or the back of the book, it has the places that you took it from. But then there are a lot of textbooks that use quotations, right? There are a lot of popular histories that use quotations, and they don't have any notes at all.
Right.
So again, when in doubt, when you've taken the exact words, put it in quotation marks.
That sounds reasonable.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. You you get into another question, sort of a much larger question, really, about how people receive history, writing about history. And one thing that these individuals that we've talked about all have in common is that they enjoyed popular success. Their works were not just read by other professional historians and their students at universities. They, in many cases, were bestsellers. And this gets to this issue of balancing professional rigor with popular appeal and whether you want the work to stand up to an exhaustive kind of examination of sources. And when you're a writer, if you're going to thoroughly footnote and acknowledge every place that you got your material from, and whether that drags the work down, or whether what you really want is to write something that is exciting and compelling, and that people who are not professional historians will want to read, and whether, in fact, somehow those two things are mutually exclusive.
Well, let me put it this way. David McCullough has a lot of footnotes, and it doesn't seem to affect his readership or his ability to tell a story. On the other hand, go back and look at Daniel Boorstin, who was popular, well-read, and honored in his time, and he had no footnotes. It's not whether you have footnotes or you don't have footnotes. It's whether you follow the internal rules, as we were just talking about with the previous caller. If you take something from somewhere verbatim, put it in quotation marks. If you're tempted to change a few words and not put it in quotation marks, don't. Don't change the few words. Keep it in quotation marks. Let the reader know what is yours and what is not yours. And the rest follows. Look, good writing. Samuel Eliot Morison was a superb writer. No one did better research than he did. I mean, we may argue whether or not his opinions would pass muster these days, because he had certain opinions about people and groups of people and so on. But meticulous researcher, but a wonderful writer. So, I mean, if you want to reach a large audience, if you want to talk to people who are not specialists, you know, 16 people who know the subject, write in a way that's accessible. But that doesn't mean you have to forget or bend or lose or ignore the rules of scholarship.
Mm-hmm. And if it is the case that people don't, today Americans don't know their history well enough, that they don't find history appealing and that they don't read it, is that because we don't have enough historians or writers who write about history who write in a compelling way?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure I agree with the preface to that, with the preamble.
Mm-hmm.
History sells awfully well. There's more, if you go into your Barnes & Noble or your Borders or your other major chains, there is more space devoted to history. There's just about as much space devoted to history on the shelves as there is to literature. So Americans love history. They love to read history. They love to talk about history. They love to go to historical reenactments. They love to visit historical museums. Where I am now in New Jersey, across the river is Philadelphia, and all the historic sites and the Constitution Center. They're mobbed. So Americans love history. So one can't make the argument somehow professional historians have turned Americans off. What we've done is we've become so professional, so skilled, and so self-critical and critical of one another that we have many times tried to write just for one another, and we can't just do that. We do have to write for Americans who want to read history written by professional historians who trust us, who rely on us, who send their children to study with us. And we have this obligation to reach them. And that means we have an obligation to go through our manuscripts, whether they're published by trade publishers like Knopf or Simon & Schuster, the publishers of the folks that I talk about in the second half of the book, or they're published by the University of Georgia Press, which is an excellent press, or the University Press of Kansas. Whoever they're published by, we have an obligation to go back that last time through and ask ourselves, can my neighbors read this? Can my children's parents read this, enjoy it, understand it, get something out of it? And if they can't, then I have to go through it and get rid of some of the jargon, get rid of some of the complexity, get rid of a lot of the passive voice, and make this accessible. And if we do that, then we regain the place we once had as spokesmen for American history, instead of leaving it to Rush Limbaugh.
We have several callers. We will try to accommodate them all in the time that remains. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have that toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Our guest, by the way, Peter Charles Hoffer, is professor of history at the University of Georgia. First caller in line here is in Champaign County, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Yes, I've come quite a far way from when I actually formulated my question. Maybe I'll get back to that. But on the point that you're talking about, the lack of engagement by what we might call academic historians, isn't part of that maybe the idea that the things they're studying are so, perhaps some of it is so heretical. I don't know where American Sphinx came down on, the liaison with Jefferson and his half-slave consort, but the we have a lot of commonplaces of American history that need to be debunked, and it can be a little exhausting, I think, to try to take that on as a task. And I think maybe a lot of historians will just stay inside the smaller circle and not try to go to the larger argument that you just mentioned. Limbaugh, now that's the widest audience there is. The other thing about comparing history to literature is, isn't it just true that not as much reading is going on as in general, in I don't know, relative to another country, another modern industrialized country, that Americans just don't read as much. And I guess I'm pointing the finger back at myself as well in that case. Would you react to that, I guess, first?
Well, I mean, that recent, what was the Modern Language Association study, or I can't remember where I read it. I probably read it in the Chronicle of Higher Education, that we are reading fewer books. That doesn't mean we're reading less. My younger fella is up every morning to read the New York Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the Washington Post online.
Right.
So I think we are probably sort of remembering my childhood, which was long ago. We're reading more, but it's not always books. Now let me skip back to American Think. I think Joe Ellis originally agreed with the older school of Jefferson biographers that there was no liaison between Sally Hemings and Jefferson, and then quite publicly changed his mind when he'd seen the evidence. But that whole episode, I think that in a way, that was a wonderful episode, because it reminded us that the planters on the hill and the bondsmen and women in the cabin sort of down the hill live together every day. That, you know, that it's not plantation culture and then slave studies. You have to see them all together. So I think that that episode sort of opened up doors.
Right, but what I'm saying is that it's still a controversial issue, and a lot of people might not like to engage that kind of controversy and step into
that. Oh, the conferences on it were packed.
Now, yeah, well, eventually, but it's been some years since it was proposed, and it's always been, I don't know, it seems to me that it's been maybe known sub rosa or under, but not in the wider, what we're talking about, the wider commonplace, popular history.
Fawn Brody wrote about it. She's passed away now. And she was attacked by Merrill Peterson and by Dumas Malone and others. How dare she say these things? And she was right, and they were wrong.
I guess there's someone else waiting. The other thing that prompted me to call was when you were talking about people ripping off papers when they were read. And it seems to me that academia is, I hear stories, and I'm only peripherally related, of graduate students with great resentment at having their ideas picked over by their professors, maybe the publish or perish thing. But, you know, it seems to me that one could just say, well, in the acknowledgement, say that, you know, in a colloquium, we our students and I generated this idea, as opposed to someone needing to have declare that they came up on it, upon their own. And that's sort of pretty metaphorical to plagiarism.
Well, I think the easiest thing to do is if someone in a seminar, one of the students comes up with this really great idea, and you're leading the seminar and you're going to use that idea, make a note at the time, you've got a pad in front of you, that so-and-so came up with this idea, and then when you put that idea in your article, book, or talk, you thank the person who came up with it. It's the same as if you came up with the idea by reading a book or another article, you'd do that.
Isn't that the exception more than the rule, though, wouldn't you think?
It's almost never done.
Yeah. Well, then one last thing, if I could, and that is, there's currently a controversy about the new book by the lawyer whose name is escaping me now. Finkelstein is attacking it, and he's not getting a publisher. Yeah, he's
the lawyer. The law professor's name is Alan Dershowitz.
Right, Dershowitz. I don't know how I could forget his name, but Dershowitz is being accused by Finkelstein that he's actually taken a pretty well discredited book by Joan Peters and basically recycled most of it. And he goes through, but he's having a very hard time publishing. And this I guess is.
Oh no, his book is coming out from the University of California Press, which is one of the big three university presses.
Well, I happened to talk to him personally, and he had two publishers before that, and I just looked on it, Amazon, and its availability. This item has not yet been released. You may order it now, but it will ship it to you.
Oh, yeah, he did have to go through what sounds like hell. He had oh, it must, I don't know how many people reviewed it for California, and then it was reviewed by lawyers. But I'll tell you, Past Imperfect was reviewed Public Affairs. The publisher sent it to Kuder Brothers to make sure that I wasn't going to be, that I could substantiate everything that I said. So when you get into a controversial area, when you go after a figure as imposing, or maybe you want to say self-imposing, as Alan Dershowitz, then you know you're going to have this happen. Let me tell you something, that when California brings it out, it's, all this controversy is not going to hurt the sales of this book.
We are at the point that we're going to have to finish. My apologies. We have some callers we can't take. But if you're interested in reading some more on this subject, you can look for the book that we mentioned by our guest. The title of the book is Past Imperfect. It is published by Public Affairs by our guest, Peter Charles Hoffer. He is professor of history at the University of Georgia. Professor Hoffer, thank you very much.
Thank you.